If you have your Bibles, go ahead to Matthew 24, where our scripture reading came from. It's been a pleasure to be with you this weekend. I appreciate the chance to come and to speak and to spend time with your young people. I really enjoyed singing with your congregation. I don't know if it's your acoustics or just your brethren, but your worship is really, really good. And yesterday at the youth rally, and I'm not taking away from anybody else that led singing for us, this young man over here, Zach, got his elbow dislocated in a football game Friday night and said, I will not miss that youth rally. And so he shows up with his mic hanging on an arm sling and did an outstanding job. And we really had a good sing at our youth rally, and I appreciate that. Thank you for letting me be your guest. This is again one of those lessons that as a child I've heard preached and sliced up like a pizza. And there's nothing wrong with slicing scripture up like a pizza, serving a little bit here, a little bit here, a little bit here. What you'll notice in the scripture reading that they read for us, Matthew 24, 1 through 3, there is a scene change. Jesus and his disciples are walking out of the temple. They end up on the Mount of Olives. And on the Mount of Olives, the disciples ask him a question. After they ask him this question, he starts talking in verse 4 of chapter 24, and the dialogue is unbroken all the way to chapter 26. And rather than slice it up into sections, and there's nothing wrong with that. I heard a guy do a 45-minute lesson on the parable of the wise and unwise virgins. I mean, that's okay. But sometimes I think by missing the whole thing, we don't get the impact of what he was trying to say. So let's look at this and let's see what Jesus was teaching. Again, with one of those didactic triads, he's going to tell three pretty significant stories, and they build to kind of a crescendo. Now, I don't typically title my lessons, but people will call and say, hey, you're preaching for us. We need a lesson title. I preach, basically, I try to do expository preaching. Just take one section of Scripture, look at the facts, the concepts, and the applications. I have come to, when people ask for a title for this lesson, I call it the duh-huh lesson. Now, I don't know if you, in Alabama, that has a special meaning, duh-huh. It's kind of one of those obvious things. And we're all guilty of it. I was in Walmart. I go early in the morning to buy the stuff I spray on my fence. I'm a fugitive from the EPA. If they ever find out what I'm putting there in the backyard, they'll put me in federal prison. If you spray it on a fence and the fence smokes, you've got a good batch. I killed a utility pole one summer. But anyway, I was in Walmart buying my chemicals to put on the fence. And this young man came around the corner pushing a double-sided stroller. Had two little babies in it, just fat as mud. He looked like he hadn't slept in years. He's kind of staggering behind that stroller. Behind him came this little girl, and she's holding the third one on her shoulder. Now, anybody sitting here knows what's going on, right? I couldn't help myself. Like I had a string tied to my face. Walked right up to those young people, said, are those triplets? Duh. Yeah, I don't know what I expected. No, the fourth one's in the car. I don't know what I expected them to say. But I knew what was going on when I walked up to those kids and asked them, are those three babies triplets? I hunt on the property up on Kill Mountain. In order to get to Kill Mountain, you leave my driveway, go around a place called Gurley Pike, and through the drive-thru at Hardee's. Just the way the map's drawn. I was sitting there at the drive-thru at Hardee's, 5:30 in the morning, wearing camouflage boots, camouflage pants, camouflage shirt, camouflage gloves, and a camouflage hat on, and a camouflage bow in the front seat of my car. Little girl said, you going hunting? I said, no, there's an Indian problem on Kill Mountain. We're trying to fight fair. You know, I mean, what do you do? When Jesus tells these stories, the response that his audience would have given him would have been, well, yeah, duh. But let's set it up. Jesus went out and departed from the temple. His disciples came up to him and showed him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said to them, do you not see all these things? Assuredly I say to you, not one stone shall be left upon another. It shall not be thrown down. They're probably walking out of the northeast gate on the Temple Mount. The temple is built on Mount Moriah. Moriah is the same mountain where God told Abraham, you go sacrifice Isaac. When they transferred Jesus to the court of Pontius Pilate, he's at the fortress, the Roman fortress Antonio, which sits off the back northern side of the temple. when Jesus is condemned to die, he's within a football field where Abraham sacrificed Isaac. This is not an accidental location. This is not coincidental. It was planned from the beginning. So that temple is built on this mountain. The original temple of Solomon would have had the footprint of about a basketball court. Been about 90 feet long, 45 to 50 feet wide. Been a couple of stories tall. Now it was elaborate, it was ornate, but it wouldn't have taken up much room. This temple is Herod's temple. It's going to involve about 40 years before it's actually finished in construction. It would have had blocks cut for the foundation of that thing that wouldn't fit on this podium. The foundation blocks, if you could get under there, and some guys did in the 60s, and they found some of the stalls that Solomon had. Some of those blocks still have big pieces carved out where you could put ropes and handles on them and drag those things around. Those rocks probably came from a rock quarry about 650 yards outside the western gate of Jerusalem. And have you ever seen a rock quarry? Just bare rock, looks like a skull. Jesus was crucified probably in the rock quarry where they dug the rocks out to build the temple. The stone the builders rejected was crucified in the rock quarry. These things are not accidental. These things are not coincidental. They walk out of this temple and Herod has built this thing, and it's not just a building, it's a campus. It's a compound. There's the main temple footprint. You've got porches and colonnades and dormitories and housing for animals. And you've got the court of the Gentiles and the court of the women. This thing was massive. And on the side of Mount Moriah, it could have been 16 stories tall in some places. They walk out of this door. They walk out of this gate. And this escarpment of building goes up. And the disciples are like little kids in New York City. Lord, look at this building. Look at this thing. I mean, it's amazing. And Jesus kind of throws water on their parade. He goes, yeah, I see it. It's not going to be on top of each other anymore. I used to do push-ups. I still do push-ups. I just don't do as many. I was in a dorm at Harding University. Could touch both walls with my hands. That's my wingspan, okay? It's a little bitty room. So I'd go out in the hall and do my push-ups. I'd be out there in the hallway kicking out my push-ups. Old guy named Kevin Klein, not the underwear guy, a different guy, would walk down the hall. He'd put his foot in the middle of my shoulders and push me to the floor. And I'd grin and push back up. He'd push me down, I'd push back up. We'd do this for a few minutes. And finally, he'd just shake his head and walk away. It's all going to burn, Jones. It's all going to burn. He'd go in his room and eat donuts. Kind of discouraging to a guy who's trying to stay physically fit that at one point or another, this thing going to burn. Well, Jesus is looking at this beautiful structure, the temple, and he tells his disciples, you know what? It doesn't really matter how beautiful it is. The day is coming when one stone will not be left on the other. Now, they walk from the Temple Mount and go down into the Valley of Kidron, and they're going to go up on the other side to the Mount of Olives. The Mount of Olives is 200 feet higher than Moriah and overlooks the city. And so I think in my imagination that once he tells them this, it's a quiet walk. They walk out of the temple in silence, go down, they go back up the side of the mountain. And once they get seated on the side of the mountain, verse 3, scene change, they've left Jerusalem, now they're on the mountain. The disciples come to him privately. Lord, you said that temple's not going to stand. When will these things happen? What will be the sign of the end of your age? Now, what they think they've done is they think they've asked one question. Because in their minds, they cannot imagine a world without a temple. If you lose the temple, you've lost the world. If the temple is not standing, we've met the end of humanity. I can relate to that. If you'd have told me 20 years ago, that I'd look at the skyline of New York City and wouldn't see those two buildings there. If you told me that a foreign power would attack and murder 3,000 of our citizens on our soil and change the skyline, I'd say, you've lost your mind. dogs and cats will be living together. Well, it happened, didn't it? They think that if you lose the temple, you lose the world. And so they've asked, when will the temple be destroyed and when is the end of the world? They think they've asked one question, they've asked two. They've asked about the destruction of the temple and they've asked about the end of the world. And Jesus begins to answer those two questions, and sometimes he'll fade into one and fade into the other, but really he does the Jerusalem main emphasis, and then he talks about the end of the world main emphasis. Verse 4, Jesus said, "Take heed that no one deceives you. Many will come in my name saying, 'I'm the Christ,' and will deceive many, and you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There'll be famines and pestilence and earthquakes in various places. All these things are beginning sorrows." My grandmother was born in 1900. She lived with us till I was in the ninth grade. She was crippled in both legs, and she stayed at our home. And we'd be sitting there watching the old black and white TV, and the evening news would come on, and they'd report about some war or some worldwide event, and Granny would go, "Wars and rumors of wars." You've probably heard an old person do that, haven't you? Granny, read your Bible. Jesus said, as long as there's a planet controlled by physics, it'll move and wiggle. You'll have earthquakes, you'll have volcanoes, you'll have storms, you'll have pestilence. Don't worry about it. As long as you've got a planet controlled by physics, you have these things happen. As long as you've got a planet inhabited by humans, they're going to fight each other. People are selfish. And when we get selfish, we fight. He says, listen, when you hear about wars and rumors of war and earthquakes and pestilence, don't worry about that. As long as there's a planet controlled by physics, and as long as there's a planet inhabited by people, you're going to have earthquakes and events and wars. Don't worry about that. Then he begins to tell them, as we move forward, kind of a fast forward because of our clock, there's going to be a time when you see some pretty evident things. And there'll be some things that happen that you can tell when Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. See, what's going to happen is Jerusalem is a hornet's nest for Rome. And Jerusalem is the rock against which many, many Roman officials have been broken. Pontius Pilates, the spear, gets sent to Jerusalem. If he can clean that mess up, he will be the next Caesar. But on an Easter weekend, according to our calendar, he runs into this character named Jesus. And there's a revolt in Jerusalem, and the chief priest and the high priest want this innocent man crucified, and in order to keep the peace there, Pilate folds to that. And Pilate basically is obscure in history after that event. He's got the stamp to be the next Caesar, and he goes away. At some point after that, a group of Jewish zealots attack an outlying, isolated Roman fortress and kill everybody there. And a guy named Vespasian says, "I am done with this hornet's nest. The Jews have been a thorn in Rome's side since we took the place, and I'm going to go put that hornet's nest to bed." And he starts marching toward Jerusalem. The Caesar dies. Vespasian gets recalled to Rome and becomes the Caesar himself. Then he sends his son Titus and says, "Got this little unfinished project that we're going to do in Jerusalem. I want you to go take it." Titus marches against Jerusalem. And when you see the Roman army coming, it's not like they're sneaking in by stealth. It's not like they're parachuting in by night. They move into your city. They build a city around your city, and they besiege your city. You'll be standing on the wall starving to death. People in this siege, Josephus says, ate their babies. The priest, in order to keep the Romans from getting the gold in the temple, would swallow the temple, and the Romans would cut it out of them while they were still breathing. He said, when you see this stuff start to take place, you see that Roman army coming, you better leave town. Because when the Roman army marches, you can tell it's coming. When the Roman army marshals its forces, they move and they build a city around your city, and they wait you out till you run out of food, you run out of water. Josephus says that when the Roman army came and took Jerusalem, They crucified 1 million Jews outside that city. They fight. They take the outer wall. They fight between the walls. They breach the inner wall. And finally, Titus is standing on the Temple Mount. He sends an envoy back to Rome. What do I do with the temple? The message comes, raise it. R-A-Z-E, not R-A-I-S-E, but R-A-Z-E, like I did in my head this morning. Scrape it to the ground. And not one stone is left on top of that mount. If you go there today, the only thing you can see is the foundation. And Jesus said, when you see that coming, when you notice that these Roman armies march, He said, it will be as obvious as what Daniel said about the abomination of desolation. It'll be as obvious as a woman in labor pains. And then in verse 32, He said, it'll be as obvious as a fig tree. When you see a fig tree with tender blossoms and shoots, you know summertime's coming. He's, you will be able to tell when the Roman army's on the march. And when you do, you better get out of town. You better hope you're not expecting a baby, and you better hope you're not nursing a baby. And if you're on the roof, leave, don't go down and get anything. He said, it'll happen so quick when they start coming into town that it'll look like somebody disappeared and somebody stayed there. He said, get out of town. Now, Josephus will also report that of the 1 million Jews that were crucified outside the city of Jerusalem, not a single Christian perished in that siege because they knew the prophecies and they left. Lord, when will these things be? This is what's going to happen at the destruction of Jerusalem. Tell us about the sign of your coming. Verse 36 of chapter 24. Now, of that day and that hour, no one knows. Not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as in the days of Noah were, so also shall be the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark, and did not know until the flood came and took them all away. So will also be the coming of the Son of Man. Jesus, let me tell you this. You can tell when Rome invades, and you can tell when the destruction of Jerusalem will be. Don't get caught in that. Now, the end of the world, I don't know. My Father knows. He has not told the angels, and He's not told me. It'll be just like in the days of Noah. People will be carrying on their business. There won't be any way to tell what's coming, and then boom, it happens. I can't tell you when the end of the world will be, but I can tell you how to prepare for it. I can't tell you what will happen as far as the calendar events, but I can tell you how to be ready for the end of the world. Verse 45. Who then is faithful and wise servant? Faithful and wise, that's going to be a theme. Who then is faithful and wise, whom his master made ruler over his household and gave them food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. Assuredly I say to you, he will make him ruler over all his goods. But if that servant says in his heart, my master's delayed in coming, and begins to beat his fellow servants and eat and drink with the drunkards, the master of that servant will come on a day when he's not looking for him at that hour that he is not aware of, and will cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites, and they'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. He said, look, I can't tell you when the end of the world's going to be. I can't answer that question for you. Only my Father knows. He hasn't told me. He hasn't told the angels. But this is what it'll be like. You know I'm coming back. And you better be faithful and wise with what I've told you to do. And then he tells them three stories. And because I'm being chased by the clock, I'm going to have to not read them and just tell you. The first story he tells is about virgins. There are 10 virgins, and they get invited to a wedding. Now, in their society, the main event of the wedding was the groom, not the bride. I'm against that. I want to see a bride walk down the aisle in a beautiful... I wouldn't swim through chocolate milk with my mouth open to watch some dude walk down the aisle, but in their society, they decided to do this, okay? So the groom's the big deal. And these girls, these 10 single ladies, get invited to be part of the bridal party. So what they'll go... And in their society, the bride's dad and the groom's dad would make an arrangement. He would come to town, espouse himself to the girl. He would go away and prepare a place for her, and then come back into town and get her. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? This groom's coming into town, and these girls get invited. Now, their job is to escort the bridal party, and they get invited to a nighttime wedding. Now, there's special rules with girls and weddings. I don't understand them all. Girls have this weird secret language. If you go to a wedding after 5 o'clock, you're supposed to wear a certain color. Are you aware of that? I had to be told that. I was told you can't wear a certain color after Labor Day. You're not supposed to wear a certain color before Easter. I didn't know that. I asked my wife, do I have to carry a stainless steel pistol between Labor Day and Easter? I need to have pearl handles. She said, doesn't apply to pistols, just applies to shoes. I didn't know. You know, if you get married, you're supposed to put an invitation in an envelope and take that perfectly good envelope and put it in another envelope. I think the dude who sells envelopes made that rule up. Anyway, you got all this stuff. If you're a girl and they ask you to escort the bridal party, and by the way, the wedding's after dark, what should you take with you? A lamp. And if you take a lamp, what are you supposed to take with that? Duh. So he tells this story about these girls who end up at a nighttime wedding. They're supposed to take a lamp and don't take enough oil. And when Jesus says these girls ran out of oil and they didn't get to go to the wedding, the disciples look at him and like, yeah. Everybody knows that. In the rescue world, in the tactical world, they teach us that one light is none, two lights is one. If you go underground in a cave, you better take batteries and lights and bulbs. If you're going to do a nighttime op, even if you think it's going to be a short hop, you better take extra lights because that's your life. And these girls get invited to this nighttime wedding and they take their lamps and they don't take any oil. And when he tells that to the disciples, they look at him like, yeah. Second story, verse 14, and the kingdom of heaven is like. He does the same thing with the first story, the kingdom of heaven is like. Well, now the kingdom of heaven is like a guy who calls his servants in and he gives them talents. He gives one guy 5 talents, one guy 2 talents, one guy 1 talent. He goes away. The guy with 5 talents makes 5 more. The guy with 2 talents makes 2 more. The guy with 1 talent says, you know what? I think I'll just hide this. I'm going to put it up. When the master comes and calls them into accounting, notice what the guy with 1 talent says. Then, verse 24, then who had received the 1 talent came and said, Lord, I knew. Now, he's self-admitting here. This is self-indictment. I knew you were a hard man, gathering where you have not sown and reaping where you have not gathered seed. I was afraid and I hid your talent in the ground. Now, the master says to him, you wicked and lazy servant, you knew. Look, if you ever make an excuse to your boss, don't admit what you already knew because he's going to use it against you. You knew. I was a hard man. You knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed. So at least you should have deposited my money with the bankers so that at my coming I would receive what was mine with interest. Now this guy's not an unscrupulous businessman. When he says I reap where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed, if you're familiar with farming, I speak in Richmond, Kentucky sometimes and I get to stay with Bob McIndoo, Windermere Farms. 2,500 acres of beans and 2,500 acres of corn. He has a big combine, big John Deere tractor. It will plant and plow. It will harvest and plant. And he says, you know, I can take that big John Deere and I can run it through a multi-acre field and harvest it just like that. He said, if I'm driving home in my big air-conditioned, GPS-controlled John Deere after harvesting 2,500 acres of beans and I come across a 10-acre farm and there's a guy out there hand-picking beans, and I stop that tractor, hop off, say, hey, what you doing? Picking beans? How long is it going to take you? A month. Tell you what I'll do. I'll run this tractor through there. We'll be done in time to go home and watch a ball game. But if I do that, I get 5%. Yes, sir, deal. He's just reaped where he has not sown. He just gathered where he has not planted seed. He's used his resources to make money. This guy said, you knew this about me, and you didn't take my money and invest it. Now, if you're like me, when you've read this story, it's been preached to you, we think about talents. I remember Vacation Bible School, they give that pretty little girl with blonde hair 5 of those little silver coins that wrapped around chocolate. They give that visitor kid 2 of those and they give me 1. I always ate the chocolate. A talent was 75 pounds of silver. This is a kettlebell, because they would actually pour it into 1 ingot, put a metal bar in it to carry it. I did some conversions one time. They won't be accurate today, but at the time I did the conversions, about $265,000 worth of silver. Your boss calls you in and says, hey, we got a quarterly project. And in this quarterly project, I'm going to give you $250,000 in assets. What are you supposed to do with that thing? You're supposed to make money with it. And it's not like it's a bad economy. Mr. Five Guy doubles his. Mr. Two Guy doubled his. The guy said, look, this is a good market. This guy doubled his, this guy doubled his, and you should have taken yours. The least you could have done, which I think is pretty evident as how insulting it was to bankers, the least you could have done was given it to the bank, and I at least got some interest on it. And you tell that to people who are business savvy, and you tell this to the disciples, and they understand your boss gives you 75 pounds of silver. You're supposed to take that 75 pounds of silver and make it grow. And he tells that to the disciples, and they're like, well, yeah, everybody knows that, Lord. If you give me that kind of money, I'd do something with it too. You got to have money to make money. And then the third story. He doesn't say it will be like. Again, he goes from a rhetorical type statement to emphasis. This is emphatic. This is fact. Verse 31, when the Son of Man comes in all His glory, all the holy angels with Him, He'll sit on the throne of His glory and all the nations will be gathered before Him. He will separate them one from another as a shepherd divides the sheep from his goats. He'll sit the sheep on His right hand, the goats on His left, and the King will say to those on His right hand, come, you blessed of My Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. I was hungry. You gave me food. I was thirsty. You gave me drink. I was a stranger. You took me in. I was naked and You clothed me. I was sick and You visited me. I was in prison. You came to me. When the end of the world comes and the King is there and He separates people like sheep and goats, He says to the righteous, I want you to inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the beginning of the world. God prepared a kingdom with us in mind. When my daughter called and said they were going to have a baby, I started building a treehouse in my backyard. I'm that kind of grandpa. I ordered two class two utility poles, 35 feet tall. I put them in my backyard. I built a three-level tower with a 160-foot zip line, a 20-foot tube slide. My grandson's 13 months old. He'd been down the zip line in his car seat. What his mama don't know won't hurt her. I took him out there, strapped him in, and we've been down the zip line. At some point, that baby boy and I are going to be on top of that tower. And I'm going to tell him, before I knew your name, before I knew if you were a little boy or a little girl, I built this tower for us. I call it Fort Gunner. Before you could breathe, I planned this day for me and you to be up here in our hammocks doing what we're doing right now. God said, before I said, let there be light, I wanted a place for us. Now, how do you get that place? I was hungry and you fed me. I was thirsty. You gave me something to drink. I was a stranger. You took me in. I was naked. And you clothed me. I was sick and in prison. And the righteous will say, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and take you in or naked and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison? And the King will say, assuredly, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these, you did it for me. The opposite will happen to the people who aren't going to go to heaven. Depart from me to the place prepared for the devil and his angels. God did not build heaven with you in mind. I did not build hell with you in mind. Now, He'll let you go there. But His intention was it was built for the devil and his angels. His purpose was for us to be in heaven with Him. Well, how do they end up there? I was hungry, you didn't feed me. I was thirsty, you didn't give me anything to drink. I was naked, you didn't clothe me. I was sick and in prison, and you didn't visit me. And they'll say, Lord, when did we see you in any kind of need and didn't minister to you? Because if you didn't do it for one of the least of these, you didn't do it for me. You want to prepare for the coming of the Lord? See, if I invite you to a nighttime wedding, what are you supposed to take? Some light, a lamp and oil. If I give you 75 pounds of silver and say, this is our capital project for this quarter, what are you supposed to do? Are you supposed to invest it? If you encounter someone who is hungry or thirsty or sick or scared or confined or weak or naked, what are you supposed to do with them? Duh-huh. It's as obvious as oil for a lamp and money in the bank. That's how you prepare for the coming. Because if we don't encounter the people that we encounter with kingdom mind focus, God's going to look at us and say, how obvious did this have to be? Why do you think you passed that person today? Why do you think you were in that restaurant with that guy begging for the leftovers? Why do you think that family in your neighborhood got sick if it wasn't for you to be able to help them? How do I prepare for the coming of the Lord? It's pretty obvious. It's as obvious as oil for a lamp and money in the bank. You guys know who Morgan Freeman is? Morgan Freeman, very famous Hollywood actor. I like most of the movies I see him in. He was born in Tennessee, and he moved to a little farm outside Batesville, Mississippi as a kid. Grew up right outside Batesville, Mississippi. He ended up buying that farm. After he got a little more wealth, he bought about 100 acres and put with it. Got a very nice place. His brother still lives in Batesville, Mississippi. Now, Morgan lives out on the West Coast. His brother still lives in Batesville, and he's a plumber in town. When Morgan Freeman comes back to this family farm that he bought and is kind of his retreat away from Hollywood, his brother, the plumber, is always, Morgan, you need to go down to the school and meet the children. Morgan, you need to go over here and visit the kids. Morgan, you need, and Mr. Freeman, in the article I read, was very benevolent. He built classrooms for the school. He donated computers. He'd been super, super active in the community, but he's never been to school. Well, one weekend he's there, and him and his brother go visit the school. I think they walk in, I believe I read, a second grade classroom. They walk down the hall of this little tiny school in Batesville, Mississippi, outside Batesville. They walk into the classroom. Young teacher's there, says, children, look who's here. Little boy about the fifth row goes, it's the plumber. See, the plumber doesn't have $1 million. Plumber's never been on a movie poster. Plumber doesn't have an Emmy or a Grammy or whatever he do, give those guys. But a plumber crawl into your house when it's about to ruin Christmas because the pipes are froze. You fix that. And when the toilet overflows and we can't have the birthday party, the plumber shows up in his coveralls and takes your business. You don't have to have power to have influence. You don't have to have money to make a difference. You just simply have to be there to make a difference. What would happen if when we left this building today and we walked into those restaurants or into Walmart or in school on Monday morning or stepped out on that baseball field or that football field, what would happen when we went out into our community if somebody went, it's the Christian? Because we've been there when people needed us to be there. When they were hungry or thirsty or tired or confined or weak or scared, we were just there to make a difference. And being a Christian is not about impressing people. It's about influencing people. You want to prepare for the coming of the Lord? It's as obvious as oil for a lamp and money in the bank. Two questions this morning as we end. Number one, are you God's servant? Does He own you and your resources? If you're not baptized in the name of Christ for the remission of sins, you still have a sin problem and you don't belong to the Lord and you're not part of His church. And you need to be in order to access that kingdom that's prepared for you. And if you are a baptized believer, then what are you doing with that commission He gave you? Are you making a difference in your community when you run into the sick and the tired and the poor and the weak and the confined and the naked and the hungry and the thirsty? And if you're not ministering to people, you're not prepared for when the Lord comes back. One of your elders is going to stand up front. We're going to sing a song. If you need to do something to prepare for that coming, respond to the gospel or have us pray for you for some spiritual need, we invite you to do so. Prepare for the coming of the Lord as we stand, as we sing.